sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Earnings season's half over. Consumer confidence falls for the month, and we have the best company in the world. That's with Frank Curzio from Stansberry Research. All this and much more on episode number 336 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz here, episode number 336, the end of October 2013, and we are making it through the year. Kind of a funky market condition as I see it. You have the continuation of the buy on the dip going on, and as well as the optimism that the Fed, or maybe this because of the optimism that the Fed will be there to rescue any situation and will in fact come out with another round of stimulus, or at least not cut down. The funniest part is, if you think about it for a second, that traditionally we had a Fed that would utilize tools like, or mainly tools like, interest rates. That would be the governing way that they would utilize, the way that they would make sure that the economy was staying level. If it was heating up too much, obviously they would increase the interest rates to kind of slow down the borrowing and the money flow in the economy. And if it was falling from an economic standpoint, well, they'll reduce it. Well, now we have not only reduction of the interest rates to a point of essentially zero, but also we have the stimulus of $85 billion per month that they're buying MBS bonds with. And on top of that, if that wasn't enough, in the U.S. only, we also have their quote-unquote, their transparency and their effective communication tool that they're using, which is nothing more than really a process of promising and telling the markets what to expect. So what they'll do is, if we do see a market that is kind of slowing down and an economy that is laying off a bit, well, what they'll do is they'll come out next and tell us that, well, they think, you know what, we'll keep on the interest rates for a period of time and we're going to not stop it for some time coming. Now, one of the things that's interesting is if you do in fact stop the quantitative easing, the additional purchases of monthly the $85 billion monthly purchase, you still have interest rates that by all standards of any historical measure are the lowest you're going to see in probably our lifetimes. At least I hope so. It's nice to have the lower numbers, but the fact of the matter is that it is also pointing to the fact that the economy is not strong enough to really survive on its own. And of course, you throw in the rest of the world's stimulus efforts, and then what do you have? You have excessive amounts of liquidity in the markets, and hopefully this is all going to be felt by the economy by bringing up the wealth effect and causing some inflationary pressures. Now, we've always talked about Japan because Japan is the model of what excessive stimulus could end up doing, and they're also a model of what the basic stimulus measures of keeping interest rates down for too long will do. They were in a deflationary spiral for, 20 years. And what we saw was just last week that they're starting to see a better level of inflation. The problem is, at the same exact time, you're seeing many of their big companies having very significant problems and dropping their earnings estimates and their guidance down because the yen is now at, let's call it 98, where it was a bit higher for a while, granting them substantial amount of power on their earnings because people were buying their products over others because it was much cheaper on a currency basis. Now, what's happened is they've come full circle. They've reached their potential, it looks like, of what the products they could sell and what their profitability is on those. And we did see the Nikkei drop about 2.5% for the week last week. And maybe that's where the money is coming from to fund some of the recent upside movement in equities here in the U.S. I want to talk about the earnings that are coming up. We have about 40 to 50% of the S&P has, in fact, reported earnings. Revenues have been a little bit questionable. I'm going to ask Frank about that. I want to talk to him about that at length. But we do have some things coming up next week. In particular, we have Apple that is going to be having their numbers released after the close on Monday. The estimate is about close to $8 on earnings on about $36 billion, $37 billion of revenue. Now, one of the things they're going to be looking at closely, of course, is iPhone, iPad sales and the amount that they're going to be selling of each particular model. Because don't forget that the models with the higher prices and the newer models have a better margin on them. And we have to see how many of the lower models that have been sold that they're actually taking in and how much of an effect that has on revenue. I'm interested in seeing what the computer sales are, as we've seen that many companies like Hewlett Packard, etc., have seen a big problem, Dell. And I wonder how they're holding up with their higher price merchandise. That will be interesting to watch. But there are about, I got a list of key earnings, about 150 companies overall that will be putting out their numbers next week. We have United States Steel, which will be out on the 29th. U.S. Steel, they're going to look for a loss of about 43 cents on about $4.5 billion of revenue. Now, last week and the week before, I think we talked about Cliffs, CLF, and mentioned how some of the material companies had been doing a really good job at providing at least a better outlook, if not a such a bleak outlook, and many investors had taken that as a buy signal off of a very solid base. And we did see that Cliffs did come out with their earnings, and they were up smartly after the earnings came out the next day. We also are going to see companies like Norwegian come out, Hartford Financial Services will be out, Allergan, Johnson Controls, some of the bigger names, Boston Wild Wings. We'll see if they can hold on. I mean, we're seeing that that stock is at an all-time high or close to it. They're looking for 85 cents of EPS on about $300 million. Questcor, I want you to keep your eye on this. QCOR, pharmaceutical company, very volatile after earnings. But what you do see a lot of times is if they do have a reasonable earning number on the sales of their, particularly they have one thing they really sell, and you know, you see a significant move on that number. And I will share with you that usually if you figure out that the number wasn't maybe as bad or as good the next day, you can get some really good action on either side. You also have LinkedIn coming out on the 29th, looking for 32 cents on $385 million. And 3D Systems, a couple of companies came into the 3D printing systems area a little while ago, and we're going to see how they hold up, looking for 27 cents on $132 million of revenue. The list goes on and on, all the way from Expedia down to Visa and Avon, and I got 5 pages of it here. You could find all of these numbers as well as the sales estimates, EPS estimates, when the earnings are going to be coming out, and the EPS change over the last 4 weeks and the sales change estimate over the last 4 weeks over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. It will be up Monday morning, first thing. So you can kind of print it off and have it as a cheat sheet for you to use. One of my favorite guests of all time, Frank Curzio, is with us today, and we're going to talk about a variety of things. You know, we don't have much of a shortness of the ability to come up with topics and then go into another topic and then another topic and then probably branch into a few more topics. So, Frank, what are we doing?
How's it going? Nice. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, of course. You're a breath of fresh air as always. We had some good guests on recently, although we had a couple of duds, I'll be honest with you. No, but it was a guest that I've had on many times, and I got some emails about this. I had a guest on, and he was a fascinating individual that now is all about, like, I don't know, he changed. He's all about, like, helping people, which is fine, but, you know, just not about the whole business aspect and all that, what I brought him on for.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I've had some guests too. It just doesn't go good, and I'm trying to pull to you. It's just, you know, they just don't cooperate. You ask a million questions, it's yes, no, and that's it. And it's like, man.
I have one guest who's great, and then he starts talking about, like, the solar flares and how that affects the markets, and I start going, uh-oh. Yeah. You know, he makes sense, but I just can't go there. You know what I mean? So anyway, let's talk about a variety of things. There's so many things that are going on right now. Obviously, the last time we had you on was before the last government shutdown and debt ceiling issue. And obviously right now we're in between the government shutdown and debt ceiling issue that's coming up probably in January or so. And of course it was right in between earnings seasons. We talked a little bit about that. There's some things that are going on that I find very fascinating. First of all, China. You know, China, you and I have talked about how, do we trust the numbers, don't we trust the numbers? But now they come out with numbers that are better on the economics in terms of manufacturing, ever so slightly better. And at the same time, we're seeing that housing prices in 19 out of 20 of the recording zones have been higher over the year over year by a substantial amount. I mean, a really substantial amount since the curbs came off. And now we're seeing that, you know, everybody seems to be very happy about China. Are we supposed to be trusting these numbers now?
It's hard to trust the numbers. If I would trust any numbers, it would probably be housing, only because a lot of times when we think a housing market's going to collapse, we compare it to here, where at one time you had to put no money down and anybody can get a loan with basically a library card. In China, the restrictions are a lot different, where you have to put down 20% and then you have to put down 30% to buy your second house. So even if we do see a collapse on the real estate, I'm not talking about commercial real estate, I'm talking about residential, A lot of that market, a lot of people have money, are trying to buy as many houses as they can in China. But the thing is, even if that market does come down, you're not going to see everybody run to the exits because they have equity in their homes, which was a real big deal. It could have been a lifesaver for us when it came to the housing market, where, you know, I live in a beach town community. There was 30 houses on the water from one person. All of them went up for sale because they didn't put any money down. They put the whole lot. It was like, I'm not paying for this. I'm getting out of here. You're not going to really see that in China. As far as the numbers go, you have to be real careful. I mean, if you're going to invest in the ETF. The individual stocks are all over the place. They don't have to report the numbers like they do over here. The CEOs, most of them are tied into the government, and it's a very difficult market where you can't really trust. I mean, we've gone over this a couple of times. I've got burnt invested in there, and I'm a person that went to China, shook the CFO's hand, saw the assets, and it turned out that the CEO still sold half of his company to somebody else and never even reported it. So all the numbers that you're looking at, whatever you use, if you're using Yahoo Finance, Capital IQ, if you're an expert or whatever, you can't really trust them.
Yeah, it's like The Sting. Remember the movie The Sting?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like you walk in there and you see these boards up and and then nothing exists. But yet everything, you know, you actually went to the place and said, wow, this is a real place. This is cool.
Right.
But in fact, behind it, there's nothing that exists.
Well, Carson Block from he's a very popular, very famous, or maybe not so popular, depending on what side of the trade you're on. But he's a very famous short seller, writes a newsletter called Muddy Waters. Great name, by the way, talking about the lack of transparency and clarity in certain areas. Well, he has been on the China bandwagon for a while, and he had a cold streak for a while, and he came up pretty hot last week on Thursday and Friday with NQ Mobile, NQ symbol NQ, and he basically said it's a fraud. And of course the stock went haywire. Stock came down, I think, about 50 or 60%, halted like 10 different times, and then finally shut it down for the day. They come out with a announcement the next day, of course, disputing the claims. And then, you know, this is exactly what happened with that company with the forestry. Remember that? That Paulson and all those guys got burnt on?
Yeah, so Paulson got, and that just goes to show you too, before you even go on this story, you got guys like Paulson who has a research team, probably about at least 100 guys that he's paying him a fortune. And even these guys who actually went to China, if they get it wrong, think about you, who you just sit in your house. Maybe you're not an investment professional, even if you are. That's how difficult it is to read the numbers. But yeah, go on about NQ Mobile.
Yeah, so I mean, it gets whacked and then it comes back and it goes down. And then you can, you know, it was, I know a guy actually who was trying to buy it. He says the line is $8.45. And it was about 12 at the time. I said, really? How do you exactly figure that number? Well, a couple of things. Okay, the stock comes down, hits 850. Okay, he's got a price in it. He's got a bid in at 845. Hits 850, goes up, it halts, and it goes up to like 12. And he was very upset. I said, what are you wasting 5 cents for? You know, you could have got. That's a true story that happened. But anyway, I mean, he probably would have been sweating the halt the whole time anyway. So it's not worth it. The thing is, what about now companies in China? For example, you take a company like a Baidu, Chinese company, of course, Sina. NetEase. These are Chinese companies, but they trade here in a different way. Don't they have higher requirements because of their size?
Probably different requirements, because a lot of these companies, I mean, NQ Mobile is actually on the New York. NQ Mobile, I bet you a lot of people have never heard of, but it's actually a New York Stock Exchange, and the market cap was well over $1 billion. Yeah. So we're not talking about a small cap, which is my area of the world, where it's like $200-300 million. You got to do a lot of research. This is like a legit company that people believe in. I don't know the story behind it, but I do know that the stock went from 25 and it's around 10 right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, who knows what's going on. Now you're sitting, and here's the biggest thing too, when you invest in these things, which is more important. Say if you do own it. Now you own it and you're forced to defend it, and you're defending, say, no, this, you know, I did my research. Yep. And it takes so much out of you. You have no idea, especially as a newsletter writer, when you're writing about this, because then you call the CFO and you And next thing you know, you're missing so many opportunities out there. That's why the biggest thing is, you know, when you have these losers or something happens, sometimes it's better to just be careful or try not to invest in things you don't understand, especially this company where, you know, who knows what the financials are because it's in China.
Well, maybe a lot of people are doing that's why they cut first and, you know, then come back. Because, you know, the incredible amount of volume and the selling that went on throughout the day, is it's pretty much people saying, you know what, I don't want to deal with this.
And even the bigger point here, Andrew, is that it's not it's not like an Ackman and Icon fight over Herbalife. You know, it has nothing to do with that where, you know, looking at a company, everybody thinks that this could possibly be fraudulent. So it's so easy to push these companies down, even if they're not fraudulent. Because I really got burned on a company called Yongye International, which was a fantastic company, a fertilizer company. The China companies were all coming down. It came down. It went from like 7 to 2. Now it's back up again. I believe there's a takeover off. I haven't followed it. But even if it's associated with China, just know that risk that even if they're not guilty, they're going to be assumed to be guilty. And you got to factor in that risk if you're going to buy these China stocks.
Yeah, I mean, and that just goes to that. You have to look at these more of a trading opportunity sometimes when it comes to this shorter term things. Frank's, of course, he writes for Stansberry Research and has a variety of different publications and focuses on small caps. And knows a lot about the markets as well. I want to talk to you about oil. Let's kind of totally shift gears here for a second and talk to you about oil. You know, oil was kind of moving up due to the Syria situation, which is not even in the headlines anymore because we have so many other things that we're dealing with. Besides that, it seems government just mishaps with... I'm going to move on for 1 second and go here. So let me get this straight. The United States government healthcare program that is being driven technology-wise by a website, was built by a Canadian firm. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, you switched tunes pretty quick there. But
Thank you. It just hit me. It just hit me. I couldn't help it. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Maybe I even messed with you, huh?
So, we're talking about oil, not health. I'm one step ahead of you, man. Yeah,
so what's so bad about that? How do we do that?
Oh, the whole healthcare is a mess. I mean, you know what? What's funny is I have my research team. We're actually going to do a whole entire Obamacare issue, Affordable Healthcare Act, and just learn about every single part of it and try to find the best plays, not only in healthcare, of what this is going to impact. And you know, you saw a lot of those companies go up in the past year or so, especially the insurers, which is amazing when you look at the details.
Right.
How much they're actually going to benefit. It's unbelievable. But there's going to be a lot of plays when you have a plan like this. There's so many plays outside the box that we're going to look to find, but it's just amazing how, you know, they're forcing this down everybody's throat. Whether you're Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter. The one thing is, if you're going to have millions and millions of people sign up pretty much within, you know, a few months' time, just make sure the website works. You know,
that's by the way, if they're going to force it, well, listen, get the forcing going, because this right now is like maybe they forced it, but now we all threw it back up because we can't do anything with it. I know people that are waiting 20, 30 days or whatever the time period is from the day that they're trying to get this whole thing done. They're so frustrated with the website process. It's unbelievable. And what's amazing is, in this day of technology, it would not seem to me like a hard thing to put together this website.
No, I mean, even with the millions of users, I mean, how many sites have millions and millions of users? I mean, it's more, I don't even know if it's so much of the website than the forums may not be accurate or, you know, linking to the forums. It's just, it's something that should have been set up, you know, months ago. And it's just, and you know what's more frustrating is everybody gets it wrong from time to time, whether you're an analyst, no matter what you are. The fact that, you know, they're not coming out and saying, listen, we really messed this up, we're going to try to do a better job. It's just the frame of how they're talking around it. It just,
they can do no wrong, the government. You know how that goes. So let's get back to oil. Kind of squeeze back to oil from one greasy situation to another. Oil was at 107 or so, you know, kind of climbing up on the whole Syria issue. And then all of a sudden, no Syria fine. And still holding up there pretty well. And even though we saw record inventories, and the demand was waning, but it was holding, and then all of a sudden it starts collapsing. Now, at the same time, we're seeing the dollar move down, the lowest in 2 years, which is usually not the case where you see oil moving down as well. So I don't really understand what's happening to some of these correlations that are breaking down and that have broken down for a period of time. It's almost like that the oil, or I don't know, what is your take on this? It's very confusing, the oil situation.
You know, from a trader's point of view, it really is confusing. From a fundamental point of view, which I choose to look at, because when I invest in oil stocks, I want to invest in you know, catalysts that are going to happen within 12 to 18 months. Mm-hmm. I think oil prices are going to stay above 90 for the long term. Maybe they dip below there a little bit, but I think they should be around $90, $95. So, you know, you had the Syria issue, and it went up over 100. But, you know, and people say, how is that possible? It's going to collapse to $50, $60 because we're producing so much oil in America, when you look at the grand scheme of things, it only amounts to about 7-8% of the oil we're actually producing in America. And that's going to go incredibly hard, too. Hopefully, we do open up more shale areas in New York and California, and that's a different story, and even in Florida, which, you know, one day we may be energy independent. But, you know, for now, you're looking at – let's talk about the rest of the world and leave America alone for a minute because we know we're producing a lot. The rest of the world is having an incredibly tough time. You look at the numbers on Exxon, and they're going to report next week. The production numbers are down every place. The political risk has never been higher. They're spending more on CapEx than they've ever spent. You're looking at $35 to $40 billion CapEx numbers for the year, guys, for the year.
Well, why is that? Why is that? Is that because they're expanding or because things have gone up in price?
They're having so much trouble finding oil. That's what it is. I mean, you're looking at the political risk. You're looking at fields that are already tapped. Now they're going more into deep water. You have Shell building floating LNG facilities for about $15 billion. They're just spending a lot of money on infrastructure to try to do the best to pull as much oil possible out of the ground right now. And it's very difficult to produce oil for more than $95 or lower than $95 outside of the U.S. So if you do see prices come down to 90, maybe 85, you're going to see supply really come off the market quickly because a lot of people can't make money. When that does happen, I think you can see prices go up. And if we have a catastrophic event where prices even come down to the 80, 75 level, which I don't see, but if it does happen, who knows what that'll probably result in the market collapse as well. If that does happen, it costs about $65 to produce in a Bakken and maybe around $60 or maybe a $5 difference to produce in an Eagle Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a lot of the companies are going to have to halt production. It's almost like natural gas. We have easily a 100-year supply, probably a 300-year supply. Talking from a guy who visited all these areas and they burn natural gas for free in the Bakken because they have no place to put it. If natural gas prices go to 5, 6, 7, you're going to see a ton of it come online, which would take a week, according to the people I talked to, 1 week to get it back online. So, you know, when you're looking from a trader's point of view, you can see prices fluctuate. Natural gas, if it goes to 7, you'll see so much supply hit the market. I still think with oil, too, if prices come down, you're going to see so much oil come off the market that prices will eventually rise. But I think more like $90, $95 long-term annual, you know, averaging those prices year in, year out for the next 3 years, I would say it's probably going to be around $90, $92.
I think what the important thing that you're also telling and showing, and what I think the listener should really take from this, is the natural equilibrium process of supply-demand when you're talking about a variety of, you know, all the different commodities. And, well, maybe not all of them, but many of them, where you have a certain amount of demand, you have a certain amount of supply, and then you also have the profitability of it. So there's really a third leg in this whole process. So when you have profitability that's going down because price is coming down, the manufacturers of a product or the users of the commodity will start slowing down their production on it because they want to keep their profit margins up. And what happens there is then all of a sudden there could be a change in the dynamic of the supply-demand, and that obviously creates somewhat of an equilibrium in the pricing.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point. It is all about pricing. For example, natural gas prices, where they are, say they're around $3.75, around that area. We probably have like a 30-year supply at $3.75. At $11, we probably have a 300-year supply because they drill much deeper. And it makes sense, and they'll put all the Eagle Ford. You know, there's no drilling. You know, the natural gas part, no one's really drilling for natural gas in Eagle Ford. They all went to oil. Everyone's out of Marcellus right now. All that stuff's going to come back. So as prices go up, that's when you see the massive production. But for people to say there's you know, a 30-year supply of natural gas, it just doesn't make sense. If prices go higher, they can produce almost as much as they want. That's how crazy it is.
Yeah. All right. Let's kind of look at some of the earnings season. So earnings season started a few weeks ago, and we had Alcoa come out and do what it usually does. It just doesn't do anything. Their numbers were lukewarm. They had, as usual, a pretty upbeat outlook, and it was okay. You know, but we did see that there has been a movement towards materials. Matter of fact, we had talked about last week on the show, I think, or the week before, about Cliffs Natural. And I said, you know what? One of the things you're seeing is that some of these material companies are starting to come back because of a variety of things. Number one, they're not going bankrupt for the most part, or, you know, many of them haven't. The second thing is that there is a chase for return and also a reversion to the mean trade that goes on continually. And even when Cliffs came out and they missed their earnings, but they had an okay year's a view for their year, they were up 8% on their earnings. And that worked out very well for a nice, you know, I think we made 9.5% in 10 days on the Trigger Point Research alerts. And the thing is now that earnings, from what I've seen, now you can separate some of the sectors and some companies, but in general have been very soft on revenue. Would you agree with that?
Well, I actually have the statistics. 70% and half of the S&P, roughly half the, about 250, 243 to be exact, have reported so far, and 70% have beat on earnings, but only 54% have beat on sales, which is interesting. So what you're looking at is basically companies beating earnings estimate, but they're not quality earnings. A lot of that's going to be from buybacks. You got, you know, especially if you look at defense companies and you look at the pharmaceuticals, which are all going to report next week. Try to look beyond, because they're all going to beat by a penny or two. You know, they always do. And you're going to say, well, you know, it's still, I can't believe that with all this patent expiration is still doing good. They're taking their fortress balance sheets and buying the crap out of their stock. That's what they're doing right now. Do that. You know, you're basically going to inflate your earnings artificially. And a lot of companies are doing that and getting away with it. It's fine because that's how they're able to produce higher earnings, but yet they miss on sales. So eventually, you know, we talked about this trend. Eventually, it's not going to last. Well, it's getting to the point where it's getting to an extreme level. I mean, they can't grow revenue. You're looking at some of the largest companies in the world, and I did a screen of this from 2011 to 2012, took the top 25 companies based on market cap. They grew sales year over year on average by 2.5%.
Yeah.
From 2012 to now, it's even slower. So you're looking at the big companies, they can't grow revenue, but their earnings are going higher. The quality of earnings are weak right now to the point where, you know, I went to Best Buy to buy my wife a computer for her birthday, her 21st birthday, she would tell you.
Nice.
Nice. Right? But, I went in there and it took me 20 minutes to get help because there was 30 people around and there was only five people working. So, you know, it sooner or later it cuts into the point where, okay, we're not going to hire as much employees because, you know, we want to try to cut back costs, and it's going to impact quality. And that's what you're seeing right now in a lot of companies where, you know, I would be careful with this earnings trend because next quarter, Andrew, I don't know if you know, the earnings projections for the S&P 500 are expected to grow by 10%.
I know, and revenue lower.
But think about this. Yeah. They grow 10%, and we just had the government shut down. We just had you have no idea. I don't know if you know, I've received hundreds and hundreds of emails of people who weren't getting paid.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that many people. I said only 7% is shut down. A lot of people were not getting paid at airports, U.S. Marshals and stuff. So, you know, you translate that into a corporation, you have no idea how they're going to spend, yet you're going to have record earnings of 10% in the fourth quarter. There's no way they make 10% next quarter. So those earnings estimates are going to have to come down. I don't know if they're going to come down now or if they're going to come down over the next month or two before the report. There's no way you're going to see 10% on the bottom line with these companies. There's just no way. I can't
see. But the thing is, how does that translate to the actual performance of the stock? Because usually what's happened is the massaging of data where analysts will go and start reducing down their estimates ever so slowly to a point that it's almost, you can't really see the impact on the stock because they take it down and, you know, from a boil to a simmer, you know, the old situation where you have a frog in a boiling pan of water, right? And, you know, if you put it on high, they're going to jump out. You keep it on low, they just stay in there until they just boil. But you have these analyst earnings that come down. The stock, all right, it just kind of hangs in there. And then they end up beating because the analysts are, you know, in the whole rhythm of this. And they beat by 2 cents again. And, you know, nobody really realized, wow, wait a minute, what has the real earnings growth been? Because earnings growth is really the issue year over year. And it has slowed appreciably.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because a lot of people, when they watch TV, even myself, when you're watching CNBC, all it says is that they beat by 2 cents. Oh, they beat by 2 cents and they beat by revenue. So you think things are great. But yet you don't know that the analysts have been lowering estimates tremendously, you know, months ahead of that quarter. And now they actually beat where they might have missed by 5 cents and missed by revenue. So you have to look more into it, earnings growth. And what it actually means is you're looking at a market that's getting more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So if earnings aren't growing, that means they're going to trade at a higher multiple. Now, do they deserve to trade at a higher multiple? I don't know. I wouldn't say yes where the economy is growing at 2%. You know, yeah, Europe is bottom. I say China's okay. But should we be at all, not record highs, record highs, all-time highs, not 52-week highs, but all-time highs in the markets right now? I mean, is everything that great where we have 2% growth? So it's a little scary here where, you know, again, when a year ago in November, I said to my subscribers, I said, look, this is one of the best times in my near 20-year career to buy small cap stocks. And I screen of looking at companies that are trading under 10 times earnings and growing more than 20%, just as a basic measure, something simple. And usually about 25 companies come up. 300 came up in November. I've never seen that number since 2008. It was more like 700, 800, like half the Russell, because, you know, the whole entire market was down. It was a great opportunity. Now it's back down to like 20, 25 companies based on that metric. Again, it's something simple, something that I look at to gauge, you know, the stocks in the Russell 2000, which are trading at all-time highs. It's difficult to say that multiple, which is 20 times on average they're trading, the companies that report earnings in the Russell, it's trading 20 times earnings, yet they're only expected to grow at like 7%.
And what you're talking about is the PEG ratio, essentially, which is the price to earnings to growth.
Yes,
and you want to have it very low. Yeah.
Exactly. You're not seeing the earnings growth to support the earnings. So you're seeing it stocks trading expensive valuations, but you're seeing growth slow. We're not getting the economic growth on, you know, if you're looking at the economy in general and even on the earnings side. So, you know, I'd be a little worried here. I'd definitely take some profits. I've been telling my subscribers, just follow your stops and be smart here because we had such big gains. Almost anybody had gains. It's not just me. It's not just you. You know, the markets have done good in the last 12 months. Be sure to protect some of those gains because, you know, if you had to guess which way the market's going to go, up 15% or down 15%, I'd find it hard for a lot of people to say we're going to go up another 15% from here. I think we're due for a correction. I mean, it's a year, 12 months straight where we've gone, up every single month after month after month. So you just be careful. You want to definitely protect those profits.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is that what we're also seeing is that a lot of, at least what I'm seeing, when you look at what's happening from a stock movement on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, that a lot of the short sellers are getting squeezed. You know, you saw that, for example, last week, Apollo Education. Now, the education stocks for a long time had been under pressure. A few guys had been really banging the drum that these things are really going to get hurt. Government came in, did a few things, but not a lot. They have their mind, they're very distracted on other things. Apollo beats, and, you know, they had an extremely high short interest ratio. The stock's up 25%, 26% in a day, okay? Even stocks that have lukewarm earnings and have a high short interest, and we like to look for these, you know, we'll find out where the short interest is, find out where there's very little resistance above. But I do see that as a trend that they're attacking the short interest. Of course, nobody gets upset about that. You know, if stock goes down 30%, you know, they halt it, there's an investigation, there's a problem. Stock goes up 25%, oh, that's good. You know, the mentality. But, we're seeing these big moves. I mean, even on the big boys, look at what happened with Amazon, which it's pretty amazing how they lost money and they are still at an all-time high on earnings. But their revenue was just superb. Microsoft came in a number that was better. It was up 6%. Microsoft doesn't move that much usually. Google was just outstanding in terms of their move. But their, you know, click rate was down a bit and all that. I mean, you know, you can find fault in any earnings, of course. But generally speaking, everybody's looking at the glass full, not even, you know, half full. It's like, hey, everything's great right now. And I think that's what you're saying, that the valuations and the PE overall is a little bit pricey at this point.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely pricey. It's interesting you say about short ratios, because it's true with the short ratios. I mean, it's not just recently. These stocks have been attacked for a while. You look at Tesla, you look at Netflix, companies, and just be careful, because if, you know, I'm saying to be careful, it doesn't mean they short the market, because a lot of people, it's very difficult to short the market. And most important, never short on valuation, because there's no limit to how high a stock can go. If you wanted to short on valuation, you would have shorted Netflix at 125. Okay, it went up to 400. Now it's what, like 325. So, you know, just be real careful, because there's no metric you could actually look at. Now, there's technicals that you can go over, Andrew, and say, okay, you know, it looks like we should, whatever, Tesla. But on the flip side, when you see a company come down, there is a level where you could try to catch a bottom. And you don't want to try to catch a fall in life, and that's what, you know, based on technicals, you never want to do. You want to see a little bit of an uptrend first. But if a stock falls down, you'll see this in biotech. If it falls down to cash levels, if you see insiders buying, if it falls close to book value, like, you know, you saw with a lot of the financial firms, especially 2010, 2011, they were still trading below their tangible book value. And now they're a lot higher, even after all this government nonsense, and they're getting sued for tying their shoes. But you're looking at the entire market here. You want to be careful. Don't short valuation, because there's no limit. I mean, you could see Netflix go to 600, and there's no limit. There's no metric, but, you know, when you're looking on a downside, there is a metric where you can say, okay, if insiders are buying here and a company's trading near book value, I feel more comfortable where, you know, I could risk 10%, or, you know, this thing could really bounce back and get a 30, 40% gain. It's a lot different when you're shorting valuation. So you want to short technologies that are maybe going to be obsolete in a couple of years. Just, you know, be careful shorting a Netflix and a Tesla. I think they're incredibly overvalued. I would just never, ever tell anyone to short, because it's very dangerous. I'm speaking from experience, because I tried to do that with IMAX, which I made a lot of money on the way up. And on the way back down, I just thought it was overvalued. And it went up. It just kept going higher and higher.
Yep. Well, I mean, Tesla, for example, we've been working Tesla on a very short-term trading situation. You know, and you do see that on a daily basis, it could be down 5%, but then it only ends up, you know, down 2%. Or it could end up by the end of the day. There's still a lot of appetite, although that seems to be waning a little bit. But when that happens, also, oftentimes you see the companies go into overdrive on their PR, and you'll see them starting to pick. We are short a very small position right now that we held overnight on Tesla, by the way. And, you know, we've been trying to take it on a daily basis. You know, if you can make 2 or 3% on a daily basis per stock on a trade, that's not a bad thing to kind of just, you know, add excess benefit to the portfolio on a position. I mean, from a very active trading standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, if you're right, you're gonna make a lot of money. You really have to have tight stops on it too, I would think.
Yes,
right?
But the other thing is, I'll tell you, the other side of the story is where you have a valuation idea and you come up with the whole view of it, and you know, you short a stock, for example, Green Mountain. I talk about this all the time. Green Mountain Coffee Roast has been kind of in my target for a while here, and we tried to short it. And after earnings, I said, "Oh, those earnings are just doesn't. That's not good. That's not right. That's not a good earnings number." Well, they were down, and then they started to climb and climb and climb. And I said, "All right, we busted out of it. We didn't lose a lot of money, but okay, bust out of the trade. Fine. Now you kind of leave it alone because it's not because it's an emotional situation, because, you know, you see that there's just an irrationality with this whole thing, right? Well, now it goes from like 85 or something like that down to 60. And you've been sitting on the side waiting and looking and what, you know what I mean? It's very frustrating when you have the situation, but it's all about, it's in a manner, if you're going to do trading, by the way, shorter term swing trading, it's all about timing.
Yep.
You know, whereas if you had a thesis, you know, you're going to buy this and you're not going to sell this damn thing, you know, because you really believe hardcore that, well, you know what, if I lose, I have a 4% position, I'll lose 4% or whatever it is if it goes up 100%. But, you know, I'm not going to get rid of this because I really, you know, banging the desk, I believe in this thing. Let's talk about, you know, other things in terms of earnings that are coming out. We have Facebook coming out, and Twitter's also coming out with their IPO. They priced over the weekend. Now, Facebook, I kind of scratch my head a little bit and just talk about the idea of valuation here. Since their last report, which talked about how they really did a much better job at bringing in revenue from mobile, they're monetizing the whole mobile aspect, which it's very difficult to really see because, you know, I've looked at the mobile and I don't really see a lot of ads going on there. And okay, but 70% of their revenue, I think it was, or something like that, came from mobile last time. Mm-hmm. Then after that, the price popped above its IPO price, and then you know what happens usually there. It's, you know, everybody's on board. You know, went from the most hated to the most loved stock. And the stock has done extremely well. It's had a lot of nice runs, and after the Google earnings came in, it really had a nice pop as well. Do you think, and I don't know if you look at this at all, but do you think that Facebook is going to be able to provide revenues and earnings to the street that match the current price in any manner?
What the street wants to see is growth in mobile, and I think they're going to get it. And it's going to be interesting when you hear this take from a valuation guy. I think Facebook is the greatest company on earth.
Oh.
I really mean that. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you why. Usually when companies IPO, you look at Twitter, which is, you know, nothing compared to Facebook. But usually when companies IPO, they do it to raise money, to build their business, build more plans, try to get more revenue clients. Facebook has 1 billion users in one spot, okay, using one site. So you have 1 billion users, right? 1 in 7 people have a Facebook account. They log on to it, and they stay logged on forever. They check. They print pictures. But here's the biggest thing right now is these people put exactly what they like.
Yeah.
They put exactly where they are. I'm checking in the Buffalo Wild Rings right now. What kind of sports they play, their kids, their picks. They provide all this information. Now, let's say if you're Starbucks, right, and you want to buy a list of names or whatever. You're going to buy a list of names. You don't even know anything about them. Or you could advertise on Facebook. And Facebook, Starbucks is going to call Facebook and say, I want to advertise for you. And they're going to say, okay, well, we have 300,000 people that actually use Facebook, that use Starbucks pretty much on, you know, a weekly basis. So what they do is, because almost everybody on there, it says when their birthday is, because everyone says happy birthday every day. What Starbucks does is they provide a $5 gift card exactly from the, so instead of just wishing someone happy birthday, what comes up is they're able to go to Starbucks and give that person, which they probably go to Starbucks with, a $5 gift card and say happy birthday. There's no better target marketing in the world. If it's anyone, and you guys know how big marketing is. I mean, you watch an NFL football game, almost half of it, not even half, 60%, 70% is commercials. Like, everything's advertising. These guys spend billions of dollars advertising. The one place you're going to go to make the most money out of advertising is Facebook.
Well, because, I mean, listen, Frank, if the government had the data and was able to track the information at the equivalent level that Facebook does, people would be hiding.
Oh, and they have, you know what's so funny is we all have GPS systems on our car. If a car gets stolen, it's easy to, they're tracking us at all times, and people get nervous. If you're worried about getting tracked, don't have a Facebook account.
Right, exactly.
Like, your kid's school in front of the school, and say, hi, I'm in Chicago hanging out with my kids at school. Don't post stuff on Facebook if you're that worried about it. But I mean, that's another topic aside. But I think the numbers on mobile, they're going to continue to grow. They're going to be king of the market. Anyone in the world, all these big companies, Procter & Gamble spends, you know, whatever, tens of millions of dollars on advertising every single year. Everybody's going to go to Facebook. And I think that's the biggest thing right now. And I think you're going to see a lot more growth going forward. I've never seen so many people so willing to put so much information about themselves to the public. And then they're able to share this with all the advertisers. So I think it's a company I definitely wouldn't short. I don't know, valuation is crazy, but the big number to look is mobile. If you're going to see huge growth in mobile, you're going to see that stock go up during earnings season.
No, we'll see. I mean, it is fascinating that you're right. Not only can you target somebody on their birthday, but you could target somebody at a particular age. And you could, or for example, I just want to have men who are turning 17 years old and, 45 days that have, you know, whatever it may be, blue eyes that live in Arkansas. I mean, you could do that.
I went to Ireland to go golfing. I mean, I'm sure that there's, 100 million people on there that go golfing. That's that. Maybe Callaway wants a target. Here you go. All these people went golfing. You got a new product. Here you go. Boom, right to that. Instead of sending it to, a 10-year-old, which you might be doing if you're just buying random names to advertise, or if you're advertising during a commercial break, you don't know if everybody's watching. This is a target market where every single name that you're going to get, goes golfing. It's just, I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, and in fact, if you think about it, Facebook then is not really a social media site or a tech site. It's a marketing firm.
It basically is a marketing firm.
That's what it is.
I mean, it wasn't set up that way, but now it's just amazing the transition that they made in the past, at least the past year, where we're not going to advertise, and they realize, wow, the whole world wants to advertise for us with all this information that we have on these people.
Yeah. Let's finish up with the political risk and the issues that we mentioned a moment ago. I find it really fascinating how, if you start at the beginning of this year, the things that were very worrisome that were going to slow down earnings or cause problems with the economy were pretty much... look beyond. You know, you look at the sequestration that happened and everybody's really concerned. Have you seen the defense stocks lately?
Yeah.
They don't care. Mm-hmm. They don't, it, nothing. It's like it never happened. I always think about, well, what if it didn't happen? Where would they be? You know, what levels would they be? You look at the healthcare.
Stay on that point for 1 second, because even healthcare and even defense companies, the reason why I recommend defense companies a while ago is, when every company has risks. We knew this sequester was coming. It was going to cut in. But these guys understand it. They know this. I mean, they're in the government contract. They know this is going to happen 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, and they prepare. It's just like the pharmaceutical companies. Hundreds of billions of dollars. It's like $600 billion over the next 5 years, these drugs that are coming off patent. But this is a risk that's on the table. They know it. So what do? They buy back stock. They increase their dividends. They make it more friendly for income investors. So they're able to prepare. And even with the healthcare industry, they're investing more into biotech. That's why you've seen the biotech industry really go up. People say it's technicals. There's so much money coming into that industry because they need to find the next blockbuster drug. So even with defense companies, they see this risk coming on. What they're doing, they're buying back stock like crazy, and they're investing in areas where the government is spending still. So even though that risk is coming, remember, these guys know it. They've been in the business for 30 years. They talk to the generals. They know everything that's going to be cut, and they also know where the government's going to continue to spend. And that's why you're seeing these companies not get hit as much, I think, as everybody thinks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other thing is that obviously there was the next thing that happened was the Obamacare that was coming up, and then we had the issue with the government shutdown / debt ceiling. Then we had the issue that was potentially going to cause problems with the tapering. And none of this has happened. I mean, it's kind of none of the things that were really worrisome have happened. You know, bonds are still priced at a very extreme level in terms of priced in yield. They're still very low. It doesn't look like Bernanke's going to step off the pedal. Yellen is going to put more on the pedal, even though Rand Paul is trying to stop that whole thing going on. It's like the government, which has been always seen as a real problem for markets, has really benefited the markets. All this indecision and nonsense has gone on.
It has. I mean, you're looking at the market, and just to flip this around on what you're talking about here. Yeah, in November, when I was really high, saying it's one of the best opportunities to buy small cap stocks a year ago. If you're looking back then, the reasons I wrote is because we have low interest rates, which we still have today. There's hard to find a better asset class to invest in than stocks. You know, and then you see, you know, the Fed continues stimulus, and you're looking at these things, and now a year later, with stocks up what? I mean, small caps are up off their November lows, mm-hmm. probably 45-50% mm-hmm. off the November lows, and people are still citing those same catalysts, which makes me scared, because I'm like, okay, we were talking about this a year ago. These are the same catalysts, and plus the market has benefited tremendously, and you still think these are the same catalysts that are going to drive us higher? I mean, how long can we have low interest rates for? Well, it'll probably be another 3-4 years. It's just interesting to see how high stocks have come and how far they've come where, you know, I'll be honest with you, I'm really nervous. I'm seeing on the small caps when they miss. Company we had were up nearly 100% on was Kulik. They got destroyed.
Yep.
Out with bad earnings. Teradata was another big data play that came out, bad earnings. I mean, some of the small caps I'm seeing, Kulik's a small cap, but some of the small caps I'm seeing, they're starting to miss right now. And they're reporting, even worse, their outlook, you know, they really don't know what's going on over the next 6 to 9 months because of everything that happened with the government shutdown. So a lot of them are getting hit. I'm seeing insiders selling. I'm seeing a lot of companies raise money like crazy through secondaries, which is smart. You don't want to do it when your stock's low. You want to do it when it's high because you can raise more money. And that tells me that a lot of these CEOs and a lot of the insiders believe that their stocks are overvalued right now.
I mean, yeah, and the interesting thing is that you know, you see what happened with IBM. Now, IBM has been a serial buyback, almost a company that is addicted to their own buybacks, and they've done that for many, many years. And the question was always, when is it going to catch up with them? Well, it seems to have caught up. I mean, it's not down terribly from where it was, but it's still, you saw their earnings come out, and the stock was hammered. And, you know, it was very interesting to see how the effect of their stock buyback still helped their earnings, but their revenues, they missed, I think, by $1 billion, IBM. That was a pretty significant number. And, you know, some of the companies that are in that area, as you mentioned, some of the tech companies have been very worried about things, and there's been a lot of disagreement. The consumers' discretionary companies have still managed to do well, and there's still a lot of money pouring into those, which I find fascinating. Because you have to wonder how long the consumer discretionary side can really hold up when you see very little wage growth, if not any great wage growth, and you see the potential effects of what's going to happen because of the government shutdown, and you see that the rest of the world is slowing down a bit and having trouble. Look at Latin America and look at much of Asia, and the consumer discretionaries just seem to have no end in sight on some of their potential returns on them. So yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah, there's two things. One, never look at discretionary spending and look at consumer discretionary stocks because it has nothing. One has nothing to do with the other. I have no idea why. Right?
Well, right. Well,
you see wages come down. You see jobs. Everybody's complaining. These stocks go through the roof. So I don't know if that's the right indicator to be looking at them. Maybe it's more interest rates. As low as interest rates are low, people are going to spend because the people. And I think you would admit to this too, especially you, Andrew, has a wide following in your podcast. You get a ton of emails. Everybody that does have a job. He's doing pretty good. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're busy than they've ever been. That I told, yep. I'm so busy. I'm installing, you know, air conditioning, HVAC systems. Like everybody who has a job is the people that complain that don't have a job. But maybe that's it. And the other thing I was going to tell you when you mentioned about IBM, I mean, if you have any accountants listen to this, that you want to talk about financial engineering.
Yep.
But I don't want to go on a record saying that fraudulent or anything like that because it's not. The financial engineering that's been taking place at IBM for the last 3-4 years, I stopped trying to read. Their income statement balance sheet, because I just didn't understand it. It was funny because they had SEC problems a little while ago, but they were beaten by a couple of pennies here and there. I'm like, IBM's on, where do you see IBM on any products? I mean, the amount of revenue that company generates, I'm trying to figure in the numbers, and as you get bigger, you don't really have to report all the numbers and all your divisions. Like GE, you know, how many divisions is GE?
Oh, my God.
It's
enormous.
But, you know, you're looking at IBM. I mean, people don't realize they do $100 billion in revenue every year.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I'm like, you really do 100? And I'm trying to figure out. I can't do it. So if you're an accountant, you know better than me, and I've been doing this for 20 years. It's a company that I avoid. I know Warren Buffett's in it. I know there's a lot of people in it, great value investors. For me, I have trouble justifying where all that revenue is coming from. And I don't get any answers, and I ask a couple questions. But it's just a company that I avoid because I really don't understand.
Well, again, I agree with you on the financial engineering because of the dividends, the buybacks. They're like the kings of that. And maybe Warren Buffett knows that. Of course he does. And is saying, you know what? They're going to keep on doing this for a time. It's going to keep their EPS running up. And this is a pet peeve of mine I've always had, that the more buybacks you do, the more you have the benefit of shrinking your share base and therefore increasing your earnings per share. And I've always wondered, and I've always said, and I probably said this to you 10 times, that why don't we have a buyback adjusted EPS that is so we can see comparable numbers? Because all the time you just see EPS coming out, you know, you may look at different metrics, a gap versus, without certain add-ons or additions or subtractions. But why don't we have a number that would be clean and would be consistent across the board for all companies, looking at EPS that is simply adjusted for buybacks? Doesn't that make sense?
No, I mean, you could put next to earnings, like how much of it was attributed to buybacks. And if you really look within each quarter, they'll figure it out and you're able to see it. I'm able to figure it out. You could just look at the share count, how much money they generated. You have to do a little bit more, you know, on the financial side. And I know, like, a lot of people listen to this, you know, this is our job. This is what we do.
Yeah, no, we could do that. It's not a question. We know those numbers, but it's not presented.
Yeah, I mean, IBM beat by a couple pennies, and without the buybacks, they wouldn't have a beat.
Right.
So,
exactly.
You know, I'm looking at that and trying to find out, like, revenue, the growth, where is it coming from? It was just very difficult. But a lot of companies like that. The financial engineering that takes place is just remarkable. But, and IBM is just one of those companies where I'm just like, wow, I really don't know what's going on. So I just kind of stay away from it.
I hear you. Well, Frank Curzio, you're always a pleasure to have as a guest because it makes my job a lot easier. And I want to thank you so much. And listen, you can pick up all of the information at the Discipline Investor, and it'll be on the website. And also make sure to get your sample copies and all the information about the publications over at Stansberry Research, as well as Frank Curzio's. We'll put the links right there for you on the DisciplinedInvestorPodcast.com under the show notes of this particular episode. How's that sound, Frankie?
It sounds perfect, but you know, I'm there for you. You don't even have to promote me, do anything. I'm there for you.
He's the best, guys. I love Frank. Love this guy.
He loves me today.
Yeah, today, right. Yeah. All right, you bum. Get off.
Take care.
See you later. Bye.
All right, bye.
If you haven't heard Frank and I talk before, and you haven't heard Frank's great podcast that he has available also on iTunes, or you can listen to it over at Stansberry Research, now you know why I like to have him on about every 4 weeks or 5 weeks or so, because he does bring a great inside view of many things. He has so many great numbers right at his disposal and research that he has. I just love having him on. He just has so many great ideas. So I would also encourage you to check out what he has, because it's also neat. We did, in fact, close some positions over Trigger Point Research. You know, we do use much of the Trigger Point Research work in our portfolios for our clients. The shorts have been just horrible lately. It's very difficult to do any shorting. We've noticed, obviously you've noticed, that anything in this market that goes down, they seem to be a buying interest on, regardless of what the outlook is. And that happens in certain market conditions. But over the last probably 5 weeks or so, we've had, four or five weeks. Yeah, we've had some really good bangers in the Trigger Point Research alerts. So you got a 14-day free trial by going over to triggerpointresearch.com and just /free trial if you want. You'll get your free trial of that. I really encourage you to do that, because it will show you how we're doing things in terms of that. And then, of course, you can listen to and look at the various portfolio management that we have over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's a quick video you can watch and gives you all the inside details. So if you're wondering, do I invest now? Don't I invest now? What should I do? It kind of gives you a little insight on how we operate and what we do for our strategies there as well. Otherwise, we're going to talk to you next week. We have a new lineup of guests, and we're bringing some newbies to see if we could stir it up a little bit. Thanks for all your email. Of course, send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com and reach out to me. I love hearing from you. So thanks so much. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.